Today, I'll be talking about a Duplex, a system for server-aided encryption for deduplicated storage. This is joint work with Mihir Bellary from University of California, San Diego, and Thomas Ristenpart from University of Wisconsin, Madison. Deduplication is the process of avoiding a storage of multiple copies of the same data. Let's take, for instance, an enterprise network, like the one on the left. Now, there are a bunch of clients in this network, and they've all decided to outsource their storage to the storage service on the right. Now, if two clients, Alice and Bob, decide to store the same file, the storage service can detect this and store only one copy of F, thus avoiding duplication. And these sorts of optimizations happen a lot in outsourced storage services, and with good reason, because dedupe usually buys a lot of storage gains in practice. Our goal is to do secure deduplication. In this setting, this storage service is untrusted, potentially compromised by an attacker, and we want a system that enables deduplication, but also provides strong security guarantees on top of such an untrusted storage service. A second goal that we want to achieve is we want to provide meaningful security guarantees in a stronger attacker model where the attacker has managed to compromise one or more clients within the network. This goal, which we call compromise resilience, is important especially in enterprise networks because of the large attack surface area. And in this work, we describe Duplex, which is the first solution to provide both secure deduplication and compromise resilience in the enterprise network setting. The main idea behind Duplex is to leverage a shared semi-trusted server to aid the clients in encrypting their files. So we take this idea and we build a system around it, and we show that the resulting system has some additional interesting properties. It can be transparently deployed on top of an existing storage service infrastructure. We evidence this fact through implementations over Dropbox and Google Drive. Moreover, the performance overhead of Duplex is modest, and the storage gains that we can get is on par with what we can expect from doing deduplication just over plain text. But before we get into the architecture of Duplex, let's take a step back and figure out where the current approaches fall short and why we need this new architecture. So one way to endow an enterprise network with security is to provide each client with their own secret key. The problem, of course, is that this is going to break deduplication. If Alice and Bob start with the same file, but they have different keys, then they're going to produce completely independent, random-looking ciphertexts, and so storage service cannot do any dedupe. Another thing we can do is to use a single client, single key across the entire network, and we see that this achieves both dedupe and security against external attackers. But the resulting system is extremely vulnerable to compromise. So even if a single client within the system is compromised, the attacker gets the key, which means nobody else can get security. Convergent encryption is another commonly used technique whenever we need both deduplication and security. Here the idea is to start with a message, then run it through a hash function to get a key, and then encrypt the message with this hash key to get C1. And then encrypt this hash key with the user's secret key to get C2, the ciphertext to C1 and C2. Decryption proceeds in an obvious way. First, we recover the hash key and get back our message. Now, if we drop in convergent encryption into the setting we've been talking about, it actually performs quite well. This is because anyone encrypting a file would get the same C1. We can do deduplication. Compromise resilience is not really an issue here. There is no system-wide secret to be leaked. But the main problem with convergent encryption is that it is inherently vulnerable to brute force attacks. So if an attacker is given a ciphertext, and the attacker knows that the message underlying the ciphertext comes from a set S, then the attacker can walk through S, try out each possible message, or do a trial decryption, and crack the ciphertext. This kind of an attack runs in time proportional to the size of S, which means that with convergent encryption, we can get security only if S is too large to be exhaustively searched through. This is a condition which we refer to as unpredictability. And this is needed for security here. But it turns out real data is not unpredictable. It is oftentimes predictable. So convergent encryption is not fit to use here. This is not a quirk that is restricted to convergent encryption alone. Message locked encryption is a cryptographic primitive that generalizes convergent encryption and captures the kind of structure we need to get both security and dedupe. It can be shown that these kinds of brute force attacks exist for all message locked encryption schemes. That's the state of the art right now. We see that all the existing approaches we have fall short in one way or the other. Either we can't get deduplication, or we can't get compromised resilience, or the system succumbs to brute force attacks, so we can't get strong security. And now we describe dupeless, which achieves all these three properties, the first system to do so. The main idea behind dupeless is to use server-aided encryption. So within the enterprise network, we are going to set up a key server, and this is going to help all the clients encrypt their files. Specifically, we are going to use this key server to implement a pseudo-random function, a PRF. The key for the PRF will be within the key server. And now if Alice wants to encrypt a file, she would hash the file just as in convergent encryption. But this hash is not going to be the key. This hash is going to be sent to the key server, which will compute the PRF, and the output of the PRF will be used as the key. We can see right away that we are going to get deduplication here because anyone encrypting the file would get the same C1. A small point to note is that the C2 ciphertext, which, as in convergent encryption, are encrypted under private keys, they can't be deduplicated. But this is OK. These are tiny. We don't care about them. And once we have this key server in place, it forms our main line of defense against different kinds of attacks. If we want to deal with external attackers, like a compromised storage service, all we need to do is to make sure that this key server authenticates clients it's talking to. And once we do this, we get really strong security. If the attacker is more powerful, more resourceful, and manages to compromise clients, then we are in the realm of dealing with brute force attacks. But unlike convergent encryption, here the brute force attacks are online. They have to involve the key server. They're going to be much slower and easier to detect. If the attacker is really strong and it's a severe attack, it can take over the key server itself. And now we are in trouble because the key server gets the PRF outputs, which are the keys used for encryption. Once we have the key and the ciphertext, we can decrypt and get the data. To deal with this, we employ an oblivious protocol between the client and the key server to evaluate the PRF. So more on this. An oblivious PRF protocol is something that's done between a client and a server. The idea is the server holds the secret key of the PRF. The client wants the output of the PRF on various inputs. But from this protocol, at the end of the protocol, the client learns the PRF output, but nothing else. And the server has no idea what input and output the client used. We need one additional property. The clients are going to be given a verification key. And they can use this to check that the server did not cheat while computing the output of the PRF. So the first question that comes to mind is, how do we build these things? Well, we can take something like AES and use secure computation techniques to evaluate it obliviously, but this is really slow and not scalable at all. Instead, we use customized or rather specific oblivious PRF constructions. For example, these can be built from unique blind signatures, specifically from RSA FDH signatures. I won't go into details of the construction, but at a very high level, the server's work amounts to signing messages from the client, and we get obliviousness because the client can blind its messages, send it to the server, so that the server has no idea what it's signing, and the blinding can be removed. The key properties here are that we get a verifiable protocol. It's a single round protocol, and both the client and the key server's overheads are not very high. Now, when we actually want to implement a protocol between the client and the key server, we also have to do with we also have to implement authentication. And a natural way to do this is to employ a PKI within the enterprise network. And when we do this, the clients would have to perform a TLS handshake with the key server before running the OPRF protocol. What this means is, in the end, we end up with a four-round protocol instead of a single round, as we were just promised in the last slide. And this turns out to be too slow. So in this system, we optimized the protocol. We created a custom protocol, which is session-based. And the idea is that the TLS handshake happens only at the beginning of the session. So the client authenticates itself to the key server and vice versa. And once the authentication is complete, subsequent oblivious PRF queries and responses happen over UDP. We show that by including some per session keys and authentication and other measures, we can get security for this customized protocol. And in the end, we get a one-turn protocol as we would like. So to see the impact of these optimizations, we set up a key server. We ran it on an Amazon EC2 instance. And we ran clients on our university computers. What we found was that the round trip time was around 80 milliseconds. And the unoptimized protocol ran at close to 400 milliseconds. But as a result of our optimizations, we were able to bring it down to essentially the round trip time plus some small change. This is this was just a prototype implementation written in Python, but it could already support something like 3,000 queries per second. Although when the load on the key server increased, the response times also increased. So what this means is if we had a more optimized implementation, we can support more throughput and faster response times. So the key server is not going to be a bottleneck of the final solution. So our main threat when the attacker has compromised clients within the system is online brute force attacks. And as we saw, online attacks are already slow. But to mitigate this threat further, we can introduce rate-limiting mechanisms at the key server. Our strategy here is that we are going to limit each client to Q queries per epoch or per unit of time. Of course, to set up this rate-limiting mechanism, we need to fix values for both Q as well as how long this epoch lasts. And this has to be done carefully, keeping in mind the characteristics of the system we are working with. So if we set Q too low, normal usage of the key server is affected. And if we set it too high, then no one can get, attacks are not going to be slowed down. Similarly, setting the epoch duration must keep in mind the burstiness of the workload. But in the paper, we show that we start with a real workload, and we show that these parameters can be set such that normal usage is unaffected, but brute force attacks can be slowed down by more than 4,000 times. And regular clients cannot be affected by these rate-limiting measures, and to make sure that does not happen, we have this fallback mechanism where clients just use randomized encryption whenever they cannot get a response from the key server. Okay, so far we looked at how to take the server-aided encryption and get optimal security as well as good performance from it. Now we'll see how it comes together towards building a system. So we start with this infrastructure. So there's a storage service, and this implements a simple API. It has operations to put files, get list files, and so on. And duplex can be laid transparently on top of such an infrastructure. So for this purpose, we can split up duplex into three modules. There is the client key server protocol, which we've been looking at. There is the key server end, which basically comes down to implementing rate limiting. And there is the client module. Now, it's the job of the client module to implement the same interface the storage system is providing, but this has to be done in a way that is transparent to the client. So what this means is, apart from encrypting and decrypting files, the client module should also handle file names and file path information. And by transparency, we mean that the client should be completely unaware of the existence of duplex. So the performance overhead caused by duplex cannot be noticeable. And it must work even when the key server is under heavy load or has gone down and so on. And we cannot store any client-side state as part of duplex's operation because we want portability. So we won't go into a lot of detail about how the client module is implemented, but instead we'll take a walkthrough of how a typical put operation is going to be. So here the client wants to put a file on the server. The contents of the file are represented by M. Its name is F, and it wants to be stored in a location P. So the client module gets this data, and the first thing it does is it talks to the key server and derives the key. And then it uses deterministic authenticated encryption to encrypt both the path and the file name. We use deterministic encryption because this is going to enable us to do get operations later and search operations. It basically works as a mapping between the real and encrypted file names. And then at the client side, we also run heuristic checks to decide which files get deduplicated and which files don't. For example, these checks could be based on the path so that sensitive directories are not deduplicated. They could be based on file extensions. And in our case, they are going to be based on the length of the file. So if these checks pass, then we keep the key we got in step one. Otherwise, we discard it and pick a random key. And once we pick this key, we compute the two ciphertexts as we've been doing with convergent encryption. Once we compute these two types of ciphertexts, we store them both on the server with the encrypted path and encrypted file name. Now, as we can see, this single put operation has been translated into a bunch of steps. So there is a concern that all this is going to slow down the system. And to make sure this does not happen, we implemented dupless in Python. And we ran it over Dropbox and Google Drive to see what the impact is going to be like. So we measured the overhead for different operations. And what we found was that put and get are the most expensive operations. So with put, running it over dupless takes about costs about 16% in overhead. What this means is it takes 16% more time to upload a file with dupless than it would with Dropbox. Get is faster. It takes somewhere between 10 and 5%. One thing to note is that put is the only operation that involves the key server. All other operations can run even when the key server is down. In terms of bandwidth, dupless has something like 16% overhead for small files, but this bandwidth quickly vanishes as the file size increases. The reason for this bandwidth is because we are storing two files, the actual file itself and the encryption of the key. But the encryption of the key is really short, as we mentioned earlier, so this overhead quickly vanishes. To measure the impact of all this in terms of storage efficiency, we took an Amazon AMI data set consisting of about 2,000 Amazon images. And we saw, we estimated the space it would take to store this with plain text deduplication as well as with dupless. What we found was that dupless would cost about 4% more space, again, because of storing these extra key files. So that to sum things up, what we've done here is we have dupless is a system where we exploit encrypted deduplication with the aid of a key server. And the result is we can provide the first solution to get both secure deduplication and compromise resilience for enterprise networks. We can show that this can be done transparently over existing storage systems. We evidence this with Dropbox and Google Drive. It has minimal performance overhead. And as we just saw, the storage costs are also comparable to plain text deduplication. In terms of future work, dupless currently supports searching over file names, but one interesting direction to extend this is supporting keyword search. And the key server presents interesting opportunities to both detect attacks as well as employ defenses. One example is we can combine denial of service prevention with the rate limiting measures we just saw. What we have supported here is a simple file system where the operations are quite simple. Instead, we can look at other file systems. And we can also explore these heuristics which decide which files get deduplicated and which files don't. This has applications beyond dupless. It is applicable in general to convergent encryption. That's it. Thanks.
Hi, this is Indranil Banerjee from Qualcomm. Hi. Could you elaborate a bit more on the threat model here? What does secure mean in the context of deduplication?
We basically want security comparable to what we would get without deduplication, in the sense semantic security. There is one difference here in the sense, because we want deduplication, we will leak equality of ciphertext. So if we need that to perform deduplication. But otherwise, we don't want anything to be leaked. So that would be the optimal guarantee. But we are also interested in what happens when the system is compromised. So we want this sort of graceful degradation to a lower but meaningful level of security when one or more clients within the system are compromised. That would be the third one.
I guess I'm having some trouble understanding how does deduplication increase your chances of compromising confidentiality?
How deduplication affects security?
How does deduplication, I guess, introduce any additional risk of compromising confidentiality?
So, of course, there is the risk of revealing equality. But beyond that, yes. The main problem is it's not easy to combine encryption and deduplication, right? So, as we just saw, the obvious ways of doing this would either do not get deduplication at all or make the system very vulnerable to compromise because we're using the same key in many different systems.
I see.
So, the natural solution is described in what is called message-locked encryption. But that also is inherently vulnerable to brute force attacks. And the work here is about how to slow down, mitigate, and so on, the risks of these attacks.
Yeah, that answers my question.
Thanks.
Thank you. Great work.
If the key server is compromised in this scheme, right. The key server can do the brute force attacks on the file, right?
If the key server can monitor the network, yes. But, you know, if it can't, then how would it get the ciphertext? So is the idea that the brute force attack is going to involve the PRF inputs?
Hi, Stefan Serio, Microsoft Research.
Hi.
Very nice talk. I had a question about the implementation of this semi-trusted storage. Was there anything specific to Dropbox or to Google Drive that implementation had to take into account? That server, when you implemented that server, was there anything specific to the actual underlying storage system that you're actually building?
So the way this is designed is it should work on top of any API that presents the interface that we just talked about. So Duplex itself does not depend on how the implementation happens behind the scene. What we care about is the interface. So that way it does not depend on anything specific.
Thank you.
I may have missed it. I'm Zach Peterson, Cal Poly. May have missed it. I don't understand your motivation for making the clients do the encryption. Why can't you just have an encrypting proxy do all this for you?
Okay, that's a very good question. So the problem with having an encryption proxy, a single node that does all the encryption, is it's going to be a natural target for attacks, right? So what we saw here was that even if the key server is compromised, the system falls back to the guarantee of something comparable to convergent encryption in our system. So even if the attacker takes over the key server, it still has to do a brute force attack to get through files. But with a proxy approach, then the moment you take over the proxy node, it's over. You get all the data, right? So there is no more security.
Okay, thanks.
David Jacobson from Qualcomm.
Hi.
So you have this system that does a very close to semantic security. And I'm a little concerned about the case where Alice likes to download music, but she's afraid that the RIAA is going to find out she's got a copy of something that she really hasn't paid for. And she wants to make sure that there's no way that they can know that what she pushed up there was the same as what that particular song is, okay?
Right.
And first of all, I didn't quite follow this stuff quite well enough to know for sure how that works, but in addition, I want to add one more wrinkle. If there's a side channel, like for example, how long it took before they had it all done, maybe someone with a side channel can say, well, that must have been there because it happened too fast, or we know that their storage didn't grow.
Right. So that's a very good question, and in some sense, it's orthogonal to what happens here. So what your side channel pertains to is where deduplication happens. So if the deduplication were to happen at the client, then someone looking at the wire could know that nothing really went over the wire, so the server must have already had this file. On the other hand, what we're looking at is a setting where deduplication happens at the server side. So regardless of whether the server already has a copy of the file or not, the client would anyway send the file, and the server would then look at its storage and decide whether it should keep this or throw it away. So in that sense, the attack that you just spoke about will not affect the model that we're looking at.
Thank you.
Sure.
More Okay, everyone. So you had that combination TCP registration protocol and UDP like custom encryption with the sequence numbers. Why didn't you just use standard DTLS or something like that?
So it is in the end close to DTLS, but what we wanted to do was to make use of the blinding within the OPRF protocol. So we didn't need any additional encryption, for example. And the sequence numbers we had to use were a bit different from what would happen with DTLS. So in some sense, we could take DTLS and tweak it a bit and get what we wanted, I guess. So that way it's similar.
Right, but that was the registration protocol.
No, if you do DTLS, you still have to do a round trip to resume sessions to get things going, right? So, I mean, you could
keep a long-lived session.
DTLS, okay. You have to, send some packets right away after you send a handshake, but it would be a little bit consistent depending on the DTLS implementation, whether you're going to send or not. So it wouldn't give you the sending the data at the very first flow on to sort of
okay, any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.